We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No Maria again this week?
No, she's taking generous advantage of that brand new city sick leave policy.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good because we don't want her in here if she's going to make us all sick.
Well, I mean, you know, the fact that it isn't implemented for another year. I mean, you know, she really didn't bother to mention that part.
Practice.
But, yeah.
All right. All right. Plenty to cover.
Starting
with local and the director of the Deep Bore Tunnel, I guess, is leaving town.
Yeah, he's getting out while the getting is good, and who can blame him? But he left a parting gift steaming on the doorstep of city council this week. Ron Painaman, I think that's how you pronounced his name. It's kind of an odd spelling, but. We won't have to pronounce it many more times, but he told city council this week that the $30 million that was set aside to increase Seattle transit options during the tunnel construction will run out by 2014. Well, the problem with that, of course, is that tunnel construction will continue on until 2016, so there's no money for transit enhancement during the last 2 years of the tunnel, and the whole idea behind that pot of money was to ease the likely chaos that is going to result when you take away a major commute route into town for the next couple of years. Now to be fair, what we have seen, and people may remember this from when there was construction and I-5 was closed over a weekend a couple of years ago, and we saw this with 405 down in Los Angeles and so forth, is that people adjust. They change their travel routines and they make adjustments, and it usually isn't as bad as the Carmageddon that people talk about as going to be gridlock and, oh my God, the sky is falling. And of course, that was the argument for the transit option, or rather the surface option, to begin with, rather than building a tunnel. But, nonetheless, this whole idea that you're going to ameliorate the impact of the construction by increasing transit and then not bothering to fund it sort of tells you what a kind of bastard stepchild transit funding has been all along in this. And we've seen this also with the car diet. What's the word that I want? Jihad, for lack of a better word, that the city has been on the last couple of years, where they're increasing the parking rates and trying for environmental reasons and other good reasons to encourage people to get out of their cars, which is fine, except that without a parallel increase in transit funding, you don't have a lot of options for people who are dependent on their cars right now, particularly lower income people who can't afford the higher gas prices or the higher parking rates or so forth. So it's problematic, and it will continue to be problematic, as we saw the car tab increases at the county level were necessary to forestall severe cutbacks for Metro this coming year. So it's not likely that they have an additional pot of money just sitting around that they can use for amelioration on the tunnel construction. The city is talking now about going to the state, and we all know the state doesn't have any money either. So it doesn't look real promising right now, and it's not real surprising that the director is getting out now before the cost overruns start.
So we should anticipate another car tab vote about 2014 to pay for that?
Only if the state legislature changes its law, because with the $60 car tab on the ballot for the city this fall, unless the state changes its law, there's only another $20 worth of funding that it can ask for. It's already done the $20 that it can do without going to people for a vote. It's doing 60 of the remaining $80 that it's allowed under current state law. And so there's only another $20 that it can ask for unless the state legislature goes back and changes that again, which it might actually go and do, because one of the things that's going to happen in the legislature this coming year, since it'll be 2 years out from the initiative that the Iman initiative that forbids the legislature from doing any kind of tax increase without a two-thirds vote and put some other limits on what people can do with car tabs, is that they may wind up trying to revisit that, and that will likely be politically contentious. But as we all know, the legislature this coming session is going to be very, very hard up for funding.
Mm. All right. Moving on, related to the tunnel tolling.
Yeah. The City Council, Mayor Mike McGinn, and the Washington State Department of Transportation appointed members this week to a new committee to study the impact of tolling for the tunnel on the traffic patterns downtown. Now, mind you, why they wouldn't have studied this before they decided to go ahead with the tunnel, like maybe in that famous environmental impact statement that wasn't really done, would have been a good idea. And they're also going to study how to try and recoup the dollars when people avoid the tunnel in order to avoid the tolls. I know, for example, that speaking personally, and I live in a part of the city where I use the viaduct quite a bit to get around downtown. I'm not going to take it when it has a toll on it because frankly, I can't afford it. And I think a lot of other people are going to be in the same boat, whether they either can't afford it or they're going to be too cheap or it's just not that significant a difference that they won't go ahead and go onto surface streets anyway. So they're talking about things like installing tolling on I-5 in order to prevent people from taking that as an alternate route, doing calming things like giving priority to transit bicycles and pedestrians on surface streets around downtown, as though the problem with the downtown right now is that traffic is just moving too fast. I was interested to see that one of the people that McGinn appointed to his committee to study the impact of tunnel tolling was somebody from the Cascade Bicycle Club, and it's like, I'm sorry, I'm all for bicycles, but give it a break. So it does seem like sort of a mess that they're kind of doing this on the fly and really haven't even thought through a lot of the implications of how that's going to work. Right now, the state is estimating, it's doing its budget projections based on the idea that a one-way trip through the tunnel will cost $4, which is a lot. And it's likely to become more than that. And of course, the other, wrinkle that's involved in all this is Tim Eymann's initiative, which will be on the ballot in November, which, if it passes, will take tolling authority away from the commission that now sets those tolls and put it in the state legislature, which would and also subject it to the two-thirds increase question and do a bunch of other things that will make funding for transit very, very difficult. So it's really difficult to anticipate at this point where they're going to get the money to pay for this project and where they're going to get the money to offset the problems in transportation and gridlock that are going to result when why we couldn't have had the surface option anyway when so many people are going to avoid the tunnel and take surface streets anyway. But in this case, we can just spend a few billion extra dollars to develop the downtown waterfront. And this is something we'll be talking about on this program in the months to come, is that we're now starting to get serious discussions at the city level about what those waterfront plans are going to look like. And whether the waterfront is developed in a way that actually enables public access, enables people to enjoy the waterfront, or whether it's going to be developed for private real estate gain, is a huge series of questions. And whether some of the working waterfront will be taken away. And there's a lot of land use questions around how the downtown waterfront is going to be developed, now that the tunnel has been given a final go ahead. That need a careful eye being put on them over the next few months.
Yeah, a lot of people salivating. All right, let's move on. The Seattle City Council having an important vote on Monday.
Yeah, on Monday they'll be voting on the sick leave ordinance that we've talked about in this program for the last few months. Six votes have already committed to passing it, so it looks almost entirely likely that it's going to pass, which is a good thing since a poll that was taken this week by Baxter's proponents showed that 69% of likely November voters support the paid sick leave law, at least Seattle voters. And pretty much across the board, it's even evenly split among Republican voters, which means that the two Republican voters in the city of Seattle were, one was for and one was against. But The real question around this is whether in the last minute before the vote was going to be taken next Monday, whether the amendments that were going to be offered to it as the details of it were hammered out this week in negotiations between committee members, whether that was going to be used to significantly water down the legislation. There was an article in The Stranger this past week that speculated that a lot of that there was a really strong industry push to try and water it down and weaken it. And there have been some changes made in this past week, but none of them has been terribly significant. Probably the most significant of them took away the staggered implementation of it, and now all of it will be implemented, as I mentioned earlier, in September of 2012. And they did some other things around the sizes of different employers. At this point, all employers with five or more employees will have to give mandatory sick leave, and the rates for it are set in the legislation in terms of the value of it and who can do what in terms of swapping shifts and, you know, all that kind of detail. But it looks like it's pretty much intact, and it looks like it will be go to a vote and hopefully be passed on Monday.
Very good. Moving on, the City Council approved this week some more money for a garage.
Yeah, well, let's go in the Wayback Machine here. We have been doing this segment of Mind Over Matters every week, more or less, since 1996. And one of the very first controversies that we covered on this program was the city purchase of the Pacific Place parking garage. Now, this was the downtown redevelopment scheme under Mayor, was it LaGuardia? I've forgotten. Somebody back in the day, did a scheme that, it was Mayor Rice, I believe, actually, did a scheme to bring Nordstrom's into the new into the old Frederick and Nelson building downtown, develop the new Pacific Place Mall, and set up a parking garage at city expense that the city then turned around and bought at way above market value from the private developer that developed it. The city subsidized it in the first place in 1997 to bankroll the Nordstrom's move, and then bought it for $23 million more than it had cost to build, and much higher than the standard value for parking garages at the time. It's been losing money ever since. And the council this week approved another $4 million in additional loans in order to subsidize the Pacific Place parking garage. This has been a money sink for the last 14 years. Given that fewer people are driving downtown and can afford the downtown parking rates in the bad economy, it's losing even more money than usual right now. And it really does raise the question of, rather than continuing to throw money down the parking garage hole, whether City Council at some point is going to consider some other use of that money and some other use of that, you know, at this point, the city has a white elephant on its hands in that parking garage. And what can it do creatively to try and fix that situation? Because right now, I mean, it certainly is a valuable asset, but they, in order to try and get people to come in, they have dropped the parking rates at Pacific Place for short-term parking to less than what it costs for on-street meters. It's now $4 an hour for on-street meters downtown and only $3 an hour at Pacific Place. You know, you're going to lose money that way. So, what do they do? It's a good question. But this really again shows how the vaunted public-private partnerships can come back to bite the city, not only in the short term, where the developer has, you know, long since run off and made hay with all that money that the city gave it, but it's the gift that just keeps giving and giving in terms of the city budget.
And the consolation prizes, I guess you get a "I told you so."
Yeah.
All right.
Not much of a prize, is it?
No. Moving on over in Longview, the ILWU is pretty active this week.
Yeah, and not just in Longview, because there have been solidarity pickets and work stoppages all up and down the West Coast, including Seattle, Tacoma, and Portland at the ports there. This is a confrontation that we've talked about a couple times before on this show, between a grain terminal developer named EGT, which took a tax subsidies to build a grain terminal at the Port of Longview, ignored the ILWU union contracts that the Port of Longview had with other grain operators at the port, and first tried to hire non-union scabs for it, and then when that blew up and became a big issue, decided to subcontract to a different union operator, but a union operator that it could terminate at any time since it was a subcontractor. So they weren't guaranteed union jobs, and they weren't ILWU jobs. So the ILWU has continued to protest that, and there were several developments this week. First of all, last week, the NLRB issued an order to end quote-unquote aggressive picketing by the ILWU as it was trying to keep what it considers scab workers, although they are union workers. They're just a different union that, as I say, can be terminated at any time, and also an out-of-state operator. Trying to defuse that confrontation. Wednesday, picketers blocked the first train that was coming into to the grain terminal there for 4 hours, and police detained the ILWU's local president for some time. Thursday, in retaliation for that, 400 ILWU members stormed the terminal, dumped the grain in something that sounded a lot more like the Tea Party than most Tea Partiers have ever done, and then took off again. And it's been a very tense and ugly situation down there. Of course, our newspaper of record, the extremely anti-union Seattle Times, has been full of phrases like union thugs and whatnot, but it's a good deal more complicated than that, because basically what EGT has done when they couldn't get away with non-union labor entirely is pay substandard rates to by trying to pit one union operator against another union operator again in order to both save money and break the union stranglehold on the contracts down there. And this is something where the Port of Longview has ultimate authority over this, but it's not entirely clear how this is going to get resolved. It once again shows you the dangers, as we talked about with the parking garage, of using taxpayer subsidized money to bring in this case, an international corporation, in order to which has been hell bent on undercutting the standard labor practices at the Port of Longview. And you can bet that if EGT is successful here, you're going to see some operators and plays in the ports in Seattle and Tacoma looking at the same sorts of strategies in the future.
All right, let's move on to national, starting with President Obama's speech this week.
Yeah, Obama gave his big ballyhooed speech this week on the jobs plan, and this really shows you how far the goalposts have moved, that Obama is being praised in some quarters for a visionary and bold move that really pushes the envelope for proposals that basically are mostly Republican proposals, or at least they were Republican proposals 5 years ago before the Republicans went off the deep end. Some $35 billion would be spent to retain or hire teachers, cops, and firefighters. Another $30 billion to refurbish school buildings. $50 billion. Also another $49.9995 billion. $50 billion for highways, railroads, transit systems, and waterways. A combination of tax cuts, spending cuts, and job spending that Obama says over the next 10 years will pay for itself. And really, he spent a lot of time here trying in advance to forestall the standard Republican criticisms of the plan, specifically in this case that they don't want it to cost any money, which is kind of an insane thing to ask for, that you want to create jobs without spending any money. But this, again, is how far the goalposts have moved in our political discourse, that you could have essentially a combination of different plans and ideas that more or less all come out of Republican think tanks or past Republican legislative proposals that are being criticized by Republicans now as being, you know, more or less socialist. And the basic problem with the jobs plan, although it is, in fact, it's got some good things, which we'll talk about in a minute, but the biggest problem of it, which a number of commenters have mentioned in the last 48 hours, or 36 hours, is that it relies on the goodwill of the private sector to hire rather than simply take the tax credits that will be made available and sit on the additional profits. This is what we've seen so far, is that many, many sectors of the economy right now, corporations are making record profits. They're not hurting in this economy. What they're doing now is that they're not using that money to turn around and hire workers. What they're saying is that, well, we don't see any reason to hire workers until there's more demand, but there's not going to be more demand until a bigger chunk of the workforce is actually working and has money to spend. So it's kind of a catch-22. The way Obama is trying to get around this is by using the money for teachers and firefighters and school buildings and transportation projects and so forth. It's a real problem. Now, the estimates have been that the plan will in fact create anywhere from 500,000 to 2.5 million new jobs, and maybe another 1.5 million jobs that will be created because of the continuation of policies that are already in place. But politically, it's a positive thing, because really, since the Republicans took control of the House last fall, it's the first assertive thing that Obama has done in nearly a year. The Democrats have been on the defensive ever since then, with the debt ceiling and hostage negotiations, with the extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy last December, the 2011 budget battles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at least Obama is at this point playing offense. And given that it's extremely likely that this proposal is going to go nowhere in the Republican House, at least it is now a stick that the Republicans Obama can beat the Republicans with as he goes into campaign mode for 2012. Because the other thing that we learned this week, which isn't too much of a surprise for anybody who's paying attention, but this week was the first major Republican presidential debate as well, where the three front runners, Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann and Mitt Romney, were all on the same stage together. And what they learned is that if these people are not crazy, they're doing an awfully good imitation of crazy in order to appeal to the voters of their base, who are, in fact, crazy. We saw Rick Perry, for example, call Social Security a Ponzi scheme and unconstitutional, and wants to replace it with state programs. Yes, those same states that are all basically more or less completely out of money. So yes, in fact, he wants grandma and grandpa to eat cat food for the rest of their shortened lives. Perry got his biggest applause line of the night when one of the questioners made reference to the fact that he's killed more people on death row than any other governor, which really, it tells you again how far the political discourse in this country has moved over the last 30 years, that this is one of the two major political parties in the country, and the other major political party in the country is putting forward what were considered the conservative positions not too many years ago.
All right, let's move on to international, starting with Egypt.
Yeah, some 500 people hurt yesterday and last night. Protesters in Cairo storming the Israeli embassy. This is a culmination, at least so far, of protests that have been going on for the last month or so, ever since the Israeli army fired on and killed several Egyptian soldiers in a border kerfuffle. But it once again has been very instructive as to how far the United States will go to to excuse Israeli action, because the U.S. has been very, even though the Israeli military, or the Egyptian military, excuse me, which is now controlling the Egyptian government after the downfall of Mubarak a few months ago, they have been fairly stern with the protesters and were firing live ammunition into the air and trying to break it up. The United States has been sternly lecturing Egypt about how it has to protect the Israeli embassy and so forth, and has really not seen fit to condemn Israel at all for the original thing that people are so angry about, the killing of the Egyptian soldiers. So that, again, once again, as we talked about with the report that we mentioned last week on the Flotilla massacre, which Counterspin was also talking about this past half hour, Israel really hasn't adapted to the new reality of the Middle East and what has happened with the Arab Spring, what has happened with the downfall of the Mubarak regime in Egypt, what has happened with the Turkey's response to the Flotilla massacre. Once again, Israel is finding itself very, very isolated in the Middle East, except for the United States and except for the Obama administration.
All right. Moving on, Syria.
Yeah, eight soldiers executed in Damascus yesterday for refusing to fire on protesters, and up to a dozen more protesters killed in the Friday demonstrations that happened yesterday. But probably the most significant development that has happened this week in the ongoing Syrian protests is the government of Iran, which is not only the closest ally to the Syrian government, but also had brutal suppression of its own demonstrations in Tehran 2 years ago this past summer. Iran called on the Syrian government to hold talks with the protesters, so there may be some movement there, but it's become very, very evident that despite the desertions of soldiers, despite soldiers refusing to fire on protesters, there's no sign of senior figures in the military deserting. There's no sign of heavy weaponry being lost. It seems pretty much a stalemate there, as it is also a stalemate in Yemen. Those are probably the two biggest countries right now where the Arab Spring has just sort of devolved into this very uneasy truce, where the government is losing authority and trying to make up for it by basically killing protesters.
All right. Events.
Well, we've got several coming up. There's this big anniversary this weekend. I believe it's the 38th anniversary of a major terror event. That being the US back coup in Chile in 1973. No, there is a major anniversary. It's the 6 month anniversary of the Japanese earthquake and Fukushima disaster. That's coming up tomorrow. And as for that other thing, which we shall not mention, because, like, frankly, somebody's got to not mention it, but there will be a number of memorial services around the and multi-faith interfaith services around the city tomorrow. And Gene Buskin's calendar, I'm not going to run down all of them, because there are five or six different ones, but they're available on Gene Buskin's calendar at www.scn.org/activist/calendar.
Don't you guys link to that from your site?
Yes, we do. Okay. From the state site. And then Tuesday night, September the 13th at 7:30, Diet for a Small Planet author Frances Morrow LePay will be at Town Hall talking about her latest book. That's always worth checking out. She's really one of our national treasurers.
Yeah, she's always inspiring.
And treasurers also. giving accounting of all the things that are due. And then mark your calendars now. September 25th, President Obama will be in town. He's doing a fundraiser luncheon. That is what Washington State is always good for presidential candidates, is they don't really care about the voters here, but they do care about the money. So he will
Isn't
be
– $35,000 a plate event?
Well, no, that's the pre-event. Oh, but okay. then the big public event will be at the Paramount at lunchtime. So plan your protests and demonstrations now. That will be on September the 25th, which I believe is a Sunday. So, yes, and in fact, it is a Sunday. So check that out, and You'll have the time off of work that day, hopefully. So go on down to the Paramount and give him a piece of your mind.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a fine local blog and occasionally a newspaper that comes out at www.eatthestate.org. Check it out.